One of the phrases that can scare a person in a conversation is the expression, long story short, because you know that the story will not be short, and they know that the story is not going to be short, and they're just trying to make it shorter, but they're giving you a lot of information. And part of the problem is that you don't really know when to stop giving information and what's not relevant, because it's so, for like, if we have a personal experience of something, it's really hard to separate ourselves or the people we know or all the little facts that go with how we know those people, which is why we have inside jokes and which is why some things are funny with certain people and they're not funny with other people. Which is why sometimes just being in the presence of another person, a certain specific person, can make me laugh in hysterics, and they think I'm making fun of them, when in the end, I'm just laughing because they're being so quintessentially themselves. And it's just a funny thing about how the world works and how life works. And what's interesting about the way in which the New Testament is written is especially the earliest texts of the New Testament. These would be Paul's letters and some of the other epistles. But the letter to the Corinthians, the one we heard from today, was written in the middle of the 50s AD. So Jesus would have died and rose again in the mid-30s. And then 20 years later, Paul is writing this particular letter. And you see a different tone in the way that Paul writes that a later church would write, because what the church wants to prevent is precisely the long story short problem. You notice the ridiculous amount of name-dropping that Paul does in this particular letter. He says, well, first of all, he appeared to Cephas, which is actually Simon Peter, which is the guy in today's gospel, the guy who owned the boat that Jesus preached from in today's gospel. So he first appears to Cephas, then to the 12, and to the brother, Jesus' brother James. So the brother James is his cousin. Let's just say that family relations among Jewish people in Palestine in the first century, everyone's their brother in town. It's just the way it works. And Jesus' brother James became a major figure in the Jerusalem church for a number of years. And then he goes through all these different people and he names them. But what he's actually giving us is one of the earliest forms of what we would call a creed. This is a preamble to a conversation which is written actually it's the next section in the first letter to the Corinthians, but we read it in the sixth Sunday of ordinary time, but we're not doing that next week because Lent shows up. So I figure I might as well give you a little bit of context. So what happens is that Paul gives them, in a sense, the creedal formula that they got when they first believed. That Jesus died according to the scriptures, i.e. according to the plan of God. And then was raised again, according to the scriptures, again, according to the plan of God. This was not as if God was caught unawares by the crucifixion and resurrection. This was entirely his plan. And then he appears to these guys. And then he says, and then there's all these other people that Jesus appeared to. Some of them are dead, some of them are alive. Total dead giveaway that the text is historically situated. That he thinks that you and I care that some of them are dead and some of them are alive. Right now, it's pretty definitive. They are with the Lord. They ain't hanging around anymore. So you see, what he's saying is that the fundamental basis of what it means to be a Christian is the proclamation of the resurrection. And what would be next week's second reading, has Paul saying to us, if Christ has not been raised, our faith is in vain. And we are the most pitiable people on the earth. What he means is this: being a Christian is ridiculously difficult. It requires an emotional and moral realism that is so painful, so difficult to undergo, that unless we know the hope of the resurrection, it's not worth the effort. It's simply not worth the effort to go through the cross if the resurrection is not a reality. And if you ever ask why your kids or our grandkids don't believe in the faith, it's because they hear the cross, they don't hear the resurrection. They don't hear what the resurrection means. And what the resurrection means is the full and total healing of everything that is human. That all of the pains of the human condition, all of the pains of the human reality have been fulfilled and made salvific, not just for ourselves, but for other people. And you can see this drama then played out in today's gospel. Not the drama, but a similar expression of it. Peter and the rest of the not yet disciples encounter Jesus. And he has a whole crowd of people following him. And Jesus grabs Peter from the crowd and says, I'm going to teach from your boat. And you know that this is important because the evangelist chooses to write it. Paper ain't cheap in this particular period in history. If he's taking his time to say, it was the boat of Simon Peter, he's making a point. So Jesus gets into the boat, preaches, and it's really funny that the evangelist doesn't consider it worthwhile to tell us what Jesus said. It's more important that Jesus is who he says he is. And then at the very end, he says, put out into the deep. And what's interesting is that the beginning of the exchange, the title that Peter gives Jesus is really quite humorous. Master. Has connotations of Mr. Slave Driver, the guy that asks too much, the guy that asks ridiculous expectations. I was even thinking about this when sometimes parishioners are terrified of the priest walking up to him because their first thought is what's he going to ask me to do today? It's like, is this some kind of charitable donation thing? Is this some kind of ministry thing? I really don't want to. Father, leave me alone. And you have that exact same exchange with Peter and Jesus. Jesus says to Peter, put out into the deep. You know, we've been at it this all day. And this sounds like the montage of churches. We've done that before. It didn't work. So we're just going to keep doing what we're doing. But if you say so, fine. That little germ of faith becomes that moment of encounter between Jesus and Peter. And he catches too many fish. Now, what's really important is that only the resurrection is the true manifestation of Christ's divinity. If we think that Jesus proves his divinity by a catch of fish, then we will be suckered in by a guy with a sonar or whatever it is that helps people catch fish. It is not a proof of divinity, but it is a realization that there is more to this man than meets the eye. And it's the encounter with Christ that all of a sudden opens the eyes of Peter not only to who Christ is, but who he is himself. At this moment, then, Peter shifts. He is no longer master, but Lord. In the Greek, the word is kyrios, which is, I felt kind of bad. The moment I said, Lord, have mercy, I'm like, oh, missed opportunity. Kyrios, kyrie eleison. We say this in church all the time. We kept the Greek. It is so old, we figured that it was, like, we didn't even translate it into Latin. We're just like, let's just keep it there. We did the same, actually, with alleluia and amen. Those are Hebrew words. Such an important word, such an important encounter is something that the church deems untranslatable. This moment when the heart is able to say, this man is Lord. And Jesus says something to Peter which never ceases to move me in a profound way. Do not be afraid. It's a very simple statement. And yet, century after century, the real thing that prevents us from serving the living God is precisely this fear. But I would suspect that what Jesus is saying to Peter is not, do not be afraid of the difficulties that lay ahead. I think it's more accurately to say, do not be afraid of yourself. For when Peter says, go away from me, Lord, for I am a sinful man, anybody who comes into real contact with God immediately has a moment of one, feeling their heart being lifted up to glory and existence, And then at the exact same time in their own heart, this realization, I don't quite measure up. A true encounter with God has both of those elements. This moment, not of shame in the sense of moral guilt, finger wagging kind of shame, but this almost feeling naked in front of a large crowd. Go away from me, Lord, for I am a sinful man. Do not be afraid. You will be catching people. This encounter with Jesus Christ also has its precursors in today's first reading, where the moment that the mission of Isaiah becomes laid bare to him, his first thought is, I am inadequate. And both times, Jesus and the angel, but Jesus is better than the angel, but both times, the message to the man is not, you are worthy. It doesn't say you are capable. The response is, you can still do it in spite of your incapabilities. I will purify you. I would suspect that even though Isaiah got a hot poker on the tongue or whatever that was, Peter has the much more difficult task of Christ staring into him. Because eventually what will happen in the church is that Peter himself, his very personality, becomes the means of contact with the personality of Jesus Christ. Peter himself will proclaim the gospel. He will proclaim that he was a witness to the resurrection, that he touched him, that he ate with him after he died, that he would see him one day, he would see him not another, and that this encounter had transformed him. But what Peter will also do, and what Paul says in today's second reading as well, is do not be confused. I can't do this, but this is God working through me. Which is why the most, let's just say, humiliating expression of Peter's foibles comes from the gospel, which is most directly associated with Peter's preaching. If you read the Gospel of St. Mark, there is no presentation which makes Peter appear more stupid. He's constantly fumbling. But according to the earliest records we have of the Christian tradition, that Mark's gospel is a direct lineage from Peter's preaching in the Church of Rome. So the very fact that all of these humiliating details came from the horse's mouth himself, that Peter says to the entire world, I am a goof, I am a fool, but look at what God is accomplishing through me. So his own foolishness then no longer becomes an impediment to service. It becomes its very vehicle. It keeps him humble. It keeps him grounded. It prevents him from starting to think that because he's working miracles and doing great things, that it all comes down to him. And we all know what happens to churches when they start thinking that it's their grace, it's their work, it's all the things that they do that make their community special. And we all know within 10 years, boom, collapse. And this great mystery of having this transformative moment through one's own weaknesses to the ability to actually do grand things is symbolized also in the very fact that the nets are breaking. That a Catholic parish, the Catholic Church herself, must always be on the brink of collapse. We must always be kind of busting at the seams and going out. Because look at the amount of people that are out on the street without hope and without God in the world. If we were proclaiming the gospel, we would be breaking the building code. We must know who Jesus Christ is, what he has done for us. Because until we have that resurrection encounter, all of the words that we speak fall into nothingness. Until we let him touch those wounds of ours, then everything that we speak will be nothingness. And the great thing is that Jesus showed us his wounds first. He never tells us to do something he won't do himself or hasn't done himself. But there is one saint I would like to share with you, because I've given you a bunch of first century saints. There is a saint that the church is going to celebrate tomorrow. Her name is Saint Josephine Bakhita. And I'll just read it. This is from Pope Benedict's encyclical, Spes Salvi. To come to know God, the true God, means to receive hope. We who have always lived with the Christian concept of God and have grown accustomed to it have almost ceased to notice that we possess the hope that ensues from a real encounter with this God. The example of a saint in our own time can to some degree help us to understand what it means to have a real encounter with this God for the first time. I am thinking of the African Josephine Bakhita, canonized by Pope John Paul II. She was born around 1869. She herself did not know the precise date, in Darfur in Sudan. At the age of 9, she was kidnapped by slave traders, beaten until she bled, sold 5 times in the slave markets in Sudan. Eventually, she found herself working as a slave for the mother and the wife of a general. And there, she was flogged every day until she bled. As a result of this, she bore 144 scars throughout her life. Finally, in 1882, she was bought by an Italian merchant for the Italian consul Callisto Legnani, who returned to Italy as the Mahdist advance. Here, after terrifying masters who had owned her up to that point, Bakhita came to know a totally different kind of master. In Venetian dialect, she was now learning, she used the name Paron for the living God, the God of Jesus Christ. Up to that time, she had known only masters who despised and maltreated her, or at best considered her a useful slave. Now, however, she heard that there was a Paran above all masters, the Lord of all lords, and that this Lord is good, goodness in person. She came to know that this Lord even knew her, that he had created her, and that he actually loved her. She too was loved, and by none other than the Supreme Paran, before all other masters are themselves no more than lowly servants. She was known and loved, and she was awaited. What is more, this master had himself accepted the destiny of being flogged, and now he was waiting for her at the Father's right hand. Now she had hope. No longer the simple, modest hope of finding masters who would be less cruel, but the great hope. "I am definitely loved," she said. "And whatever happens to me, I am awaited by this love, and so my life is good." Through the knowledge of this hope, she was redeemed, no longer a slave, but a free child of God. The liberation that she had received through her encounter with the God of Jesus Christ, she felt that she had to extend. It had to be extended on to others, to the greatest number of people. The hope born in her, which had redeemed her, she could not keep to herself. This hope had to reach many, to reach everybody. When we do service in our church, it's not simply to be a busybody and to keep ourselves busy. It's in fact to participate in this great mission of bringing fish out of the ocean of chaos. But there's one difficulty with this particular metaphor. All you can do with the fish is eat it. And that's not really all that good for the fish. But when we catch fish, we bring them out, we feed them, we tend them, we care for them, and then they transform. No longer a fish, no longer even a slave, but someone you can call a friend.